Buddy, I'm Beattie Cohn Reddos, and welcome, welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And these days, I think that almost all of us need to reach out and ask for help, whether or not it's with friends or family or hotlines or even therapists. Look at what we are all having to deal with. I mean, typically, 16 million adults in the United States, which translates into 1 in 5 Americans, are suffering from depression. 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And with the impact of the coronavirus, look at how it has affected our life, our jobs, our health, our social relationships, our mental health. Am I going to lose my business? And as I drive around New York City, and this morning I had to take a via to see my chiropractor, and more stores are closing. People are going out of businesses. People are being downsized. They are losing their jobs. The issue as September is almost really upon us, although I certainly don't want to rush the summer. Homeschooling. What are we going to do? How are we going to work? And should we send our kids to school or should we homeschool? But you don't feel really prepared to be able to do an adequate job with homeschooling, our children. There's still a real, real concern if you listen to the experts, the science experts in our country. We're not over the hill by any stretch of the imagination as far as the pandemic goes. Am I going to lose my health care? Do I have health insurance? What if I get sick? And what I'm finding with more and more of my patients that the isolation is really, really, a killer. And a couple of weeks ago on the Ask Beattie Show, I was talking about chatbots. This is artificial intelligence. And, initially we think, gosh, what is going on in our society when people are having to speak to robots? And yet what I feel very, very strongly about as a psychotherapist is that when you need to talk to somebody, and if a robot, if artificial intelligence is going to help you to alleviate your depression and your isolation and your anxiety, then so be it. And what we're seeing too, and hopefully the weather is really nice now that people are actually starting to get out more and more. And hopefully you are wearing masks and are keeping the social distance. So hopefully you're going to be eating less and exercising more. But, to not sugarcoat this, I mean, this is a really, really, really challenging time for all of us. I mean, I haven't seen a live patient since March. And I'm one of the fortunate ones that I'm able to do my psychotherapy and my sex therapy on Zoom. I haven't been to the Progressive Radio Network studio since March, and I'm missing the gang. But listen, the reality is what it is, and we are having to accommodate. And yet I was reading an article just before the show from the Massachusetts General Hospital, and the heading is Depression on the Rise During COVID-19, Resources for Patients and Their Families. So listen to what's really going on. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, they reported that now a third of Americans, not 1 in 5, but a third of Americans are now showing signs of clinical depression and anxiety. And these and other mental conditions are becoming amplified during the recent pandemic. And patients and their families are also at high risk to develop depression and anxiety, which is why you need to do whatever it is that you need to do, including reaching out to me, calling me on the Ask Beauty Show. The number is 888-874-4888. Reaching out to friends. Hopefully you have family that is responsive and friends who you can really, really be authentic with, rather than just keep a stiff upper lip and say, yes, everything is okay, when inside you feel like you may be dying. Dr. Mauricio Fava, and he is a psychiatrist in chief within the Department of Psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. He is not surprised by the correlation between mental health conditions and COVID-19. Again, the fear of getting sick, the unprecedented physical distancing, financial concerns, including unemployment and housing insecurity and loss of community and reduced access to caregivers. So many people, including me, I haven't seen my daughter, Jordana, since the end of February. I'm concerned. She and her family, they live in Hudson. Jim and I live in New York City. And the baby goes to daycare, so that we are all a little reluctant to hug and reconnect physically. And it's hard. I mean, it's a good thing that we have Facebook Live and we have Zoom and we have the telephone, but it's really not the same. But the doctor notes that there are many resources for people suffering from mental health conditions, including mindfulness and telepsychiatry. Who ever thought that we would be doing therapy? And it's becoming more and more routine on Facebook Live and on the phone and on Zoom. And physical distancing in particular has made the COVID-19 pandemic challenging for people with mental health conditions. People are really not able to leave the home for support from their religious or spiritual community, for example. I know that our religious community in East Hampton is on Zoom. We are trying, the rabbi is trying very hard to have Shabbat services, Friday night services on the beach. But again, it really depends with what is going on. And they may also be avoiding seeing their doctor. I know many, many doctors who are not seeing patients in their office. So they are, of course, resorting to Zoom. So we've had to make an awful lot of changes and accommodations. And, of course, all of these things can lead to increasing rates of depression and anxiety. And since it is difficult to connect with others, Dr. Fava recommends that people try to get a good night's sleep. Are you sleeping well, even though it's very, very hot, particularly here in New York City, and to maintain good nutrition habits and stick with exercise routines? How important that is to try and relax. But one thing that has happened, of course, is that with COVID-19, it has made it easier than ever to get treatment from a mental health provider via the virtual visits. In fact, in March 2019, Mass General providers saw a 5% of patients through telepsychiatry, either over video or phone calls. And since March 2020, they now see 97% of patients virtually. And, of course, I see 100% of my patients virtually. You know, the plus, of course, in psychiatry and in mental health is that we don't need to do a physical examination or procedures, and so that our delivery of care can actually be virtual and that we are able to reach out to patients wherever they are to deliver care. So patients who are no longer experiencing the added stress of having to visit their therapist in person, although my patients tell me that we all really miss just seeing each other. I mean, we're having the conversations, we are dealing with the issues, but clearly it is not the same. And you know what I've been saying for years and years, and today is the 307th Ask BD show here on the Progressive Radio Network, is that you really have to give yourself permission to reach out and ask for help when things get to be just too much to bear, when things are really interfering with the quality of your life and the quality of your relationships. And we don't need to navigate all the challenges, the pre-COVID challenges and the COVID challenges and the post-COVID challenges on our own. And I continue to look at the divorce statistics with third marriages, 74%. And the suicide statistics, which are actually going up since the pandemic, they're very, very disconcerting. Suicide attempts by young people quadrupled over 6 years. Since 2011, there's been a 40% increase nationally by self-poisoning by young people. I don't have any very, very young people in my practice, and it would be so interesting to be talking to people in their late teens and early 20s about what is it that's going on that so many young people are wanting to kill themselves. Suicide rates amongst people ages 10 to 24 increased by 56%. And you kind of wonder, now that the children are not in the school, they are no longer going to have access to the nurse and the school psychologist and the school social worker before. And you kind of wonder what parents are going to be doing if they happen to see that their young children and older children too are struggling. We look at the domestic violence statistics. Homicide by intimate partners increased by 26% from 2010 to 2017. And of course, with all of the isolation, if you happen to be living in a domestic violence kind of situation, it is particularly difficult. In fact, I was interviewed last week by someone, and you know, I was saying how important it is for women who are in these kinds of situations to at least for a short period of time do everything possible to not escalate things, and of course to be able to reach out, whether it's to counselors or friends and families, and come up with a viable plan, which may very well include leaving. Four women are killed every day by their partners. In fact, the federal government, they are spending $55 billion on dealing with the effects of childhood exposure to domestic violence. And of course, I think about this. There are so many podcasts and self-help books and movies and all kinds of venues that deal with relationships and domestic violence. And somehow we are continuing to miss the boat. The statistics you would think would be going down, but they are not going down. They are going up. But if there is one thing that I want you to take away, is that you really don't need to deal with life crisis and stresses on your own. And I know that even though we're much more open to talking about depression and anxiety and suicide and domestic violence and getting help and psychotherapy, I think that a lot of people are still somewhat reluctant. But all I can tell you is that it is a strength. It is a strength when you are able to say to yourself, I can't cope on my own and I need help. And taking that first step, and it's a very, very, very important step. I promise you that it can change your life and it can change your relationships forever. Well, usually, of course, I spend most of the show talking about relationships and talking about sex. But there was a piece, in the New York Times today that I wanted to discuss with you. And I began the discussion this morning with my husband, Jim. And the headline in the New York Times was Racism That Lingers at Medical Schools. And this is an opinion piece, and it was written by a Dr. Damon Tweedy, who I am going to find, and I am going to want to interview him on the Ask Beatty Show. Dr. Tweedy is an associate professor of psychiatry at Duke University School of Medicine, and he is the author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflection on Race and Medicine. And this is what he says. A senior white physician, and just think about this, because all of us, I think we would like to see ourselves as very liberal and that we are fighting racism in various different ways. So this is what he said. A senior white physician stands by silently as a white patient uses a slur to describe a black nurse. What about this? A middle-aged doctor asks a black student why the lower-income black patients in the clinic aren't able to speak and act the way she does. And then several other doctors make fun of black-sounding names in a newborn unit and speculate when each infant will later enter the penal system. I mean, that is really disgusting. And instances of racism like these are happening in medical schools across America today, Dr. Tweedy says, just as they happened when I was a medical student 20 years ago. And then he says, I recall the afternoon many years ago when a patient angrily suggested, this was a patient of his, that I go back to Africa and stay there. And the shrug that my white supervisor offered when I told him what happened. And I'll also never forget when a Muslim student's name was mocked by a senior doctor who questioned whether he was a terrorist. Nor will I forget the moment I saw black patients' intelligence, motivation, and truthfulness questioned. So facing the power, and that's the whole thing. What happens if we're dealing with those above us? He goes on to say, I remember many of my peers and me putting our heads down, just enduring on our way to becoming full-fledged doctors, but the sting never faded. Well, I decided, this was at the last minute, to have a really significant conversation with my husband, Jim Vredos, who is a sociologist, a criminologist, and host of the Radical Imagination on MNN cable television. So welcome, honey. I'm really glad that we can have this conversation on the Ask Beatty Show. Hello?
Hi, this
okay,
is Jim.
Hi.
This is Jim.
I hope you heard my introductory remarks.
You know what? I dialed the wrong number, and I was a little late, and I did miss those. So could you summarize it?
I mean, here we have situations where so many people believe that they are very liberal and they are very progressive. And yet the question and the issues that you and I were discussing this morning is what to do. What to do? We're at a party. We're at a forum, and we hear people making really disgusting racist comments, jokes, put downs. What do you suggest, especially if it's a situation where the person who is making these derogatory comments happens to be our boss, happens to be a superior? What do you feel is the best way that we should be dealing, and we do need to deal, with people who are communicating in racist ways with racist language?
Well, it's a monumental, profound question. First of all, I would say that just because one identifies or is seen as liberal, progressive, or whatever, Marxist, conservative, racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, et cetera, sexism, cuts across so-called labels. I think we've got to first see we're human beings. And we're trying desperately and valiantly, I think, to have that discussion in the country. It's a long overdue discussion on racism, and we are through various fits and starts trying to have it at a lot of different levels, politically, culturally, socially, individually, between the police and protesters, between blacks and whites, between suburbanites and urbanites. We unfortunately don't have a president that's at all adept at leading this discussion. But even Obama, I think he had one rather limited, although it was a good discussion of not about an hour or so on race relations, in which he was very good. But that was about it. And we still, for example, haven't apologized for slavery, let alone what we've done to Native Americans. So we have a long, long way to go in this national conversation. But on the other hand, we're starting to make progress, and people are speaking out, especially young people. So I don't know, that could be for starters now, that when you talk about specific situations,
complicated. Let me just stop you for a second. You're at a meeting, okay? And you are at a meeting with your boss. And your boss has a lot of clout to promote you, to demote you, and your boss or superior is making really disgusting jokes, using really disgusting language about African Americans and any other minority group. What do you suggest in a situation like that people do?
I've been, as you know, rather fortunate not having any sort of traditional or typical boss, although in the academic world, there are stratified levels of people you have to work with and so on. But
what do you do?
Look,
what do you say?
Look, it depends, on the individual and what you hear, what the circumstances are, what is being said, what specific terms are being used. As you know, I generally, from very, very early on, was trained or socialized or through my family to speak out and publicly. And I remember as a little kid, New York kid, and I would see a cop, let's say, abusing someone on the street, and I would speak out. I would, a little 5-year-old kid, and so that was part of my particular family background. So as we sort of mature and try to come to grips with more and more people, as we encounter more and more of these sorts of interactions, as we develop and grow, I think we have to be smarter and figure out, what is it we're trying to accomplish there? It's not just about ventilating. Are we trying to have a conversation with people? You talk a lot about, the internet and Facebook and so on. And so much of that is just a lot of slurs. I mean, there's no discussion there. It's a bunch of people, a lot of people just venting their anger and hatred and so on. So we're not getting very far on that. You mentioned about the meeting. I mean, in a faculty meeting, if there's some sort of derogatory reference to a particular group.
What do you say? It's your boss. It's your boss or a colleague.
You speak out. You
or
say,
some senior person. You need to speak out.
You say, look, this is not the sort of language, the attitude that I feel comfortable with. I wonder why you're using it. You try, in a sense, to bring that person out, if in fact you can, if they're willing to, if they go on and on. I mean, these are hypothetical situations. I know you're bringing up, Beattie, but so in each situation, it's something that the person involved has to spontaneously respond to and react, and in their own individual way, with their own moral integrity.
Dr. Tweedy recalls a situation, and this was in the piece in the New York Times today. He says, I recall the afternoon many years ago when a patient angrily suggested that I go back to Africa and stay there, and the shrug that my white supervisor offered when I told him what happened. Now, we talked about this. If I had a patient who made anti-Semitic remarks or who made disgusting comments, whether or not it was about African-Americans or minority groups or Jews, I'm the kind of a person who would say, listen, I think that it would be in your best interest and my best interest that you find another therapist. I don't want to have to deal with that over and above the depression and the anxiety and the substance abuse and the domestic violence.
But Dr. Tweedy was saying that in the old days,
they just kind of sucked it up and bent their heads down, enduring their way. And, of course, things now are changing.
Well, that's a very valid response that you told us about that in terms of what you might do in that particular situation. Now, also as a therapist, you might have considered that this person is a troubled person, angry person, a hateful person, that this was somewhat connected to the way he was not getting along, let's say, with a spouse or a child or his own self-destructiveness and so on. So you might have said something like, listen, this is a very inappropriate, in my opinion, way of responding, and your statement is offensive. But let's explore. Why do you feel that way about this particular group or not? What is it that brought you to this sort of statement or conclusion? And try to make it something that they can learn from therapeutically, perhaps. And I try to do the same thing in my classes with students who are embittered about this or that, or resentful about particular groups or that, this or that, or don't understand what other groups are going through, and so on. Again, the doctor, the physician, might have said, I don't know exactly what the circumstances was he giving a physical or talking to this person about their medical situation, and he might have just said, listen, I'm your physician at this point. I find your statement offensive. I'd like to know why you say this. I'm willing to work with you, but not if you're going to harbor these sorts of feelings. So either explain it to me, or, as you would say before, get another physician. And furthermore, going to the white supervisor and not getting some sort of positive reinforcement and backing of that is outrageous. That's even worse than what the person said to him. To have someone in power be indifferent, we talked about that a little earlier today, to be indifferent to the injustice, as Abraham Joshua Heschel pointed out, is worse than the injustice itself.
Interesting is in this article. race-based biology remains mainstream, and of course he's talking about in medicine, for much of the 20th century. And this allowed for some of medicine's most egregious sins. And he goes on to say, as recently as the 1970s, black people were experimented upon under the guise of scientific study.
Science,
and
absolutely.
Sterilized without their
eugenics
consent.
And all kinds of nonsense,
Exactly. But I think that each of us, do you not agree, has an opportunity to try to, as you say, to educate people. I'm currently seeing a man. And he is in therapy, and he is completely over the top upset because that there is talk about reparations, Medicaid patients do not have to pay for their treatment. They do not have to pay for their medicine. And I hear this on an ongoing basis and have been trying to work with him about understanding how, of course, we all deserve to have a single-payer system.
Exactly, that's the point.
We all deserve to not have to worry about health care, of course, as we do not have to worry in Canada. And yet, when we hear these kinds of comments, socially or at work, do you not agree that our responsibility as human beings is to speak up and not just look the other way and say that so-and-so is having a bad day and it's not my place and it's not the context to be discussing racism and inequality at the workplace? So your position is we need to speak up.
Yeah. I mean, generally, in some way, to go back to the reference you gave to the history of science, absolutely, there's all kinds of horrible experiments and justification, categorization of people through science. So if you're a scientist, take up that history, get to know it, and write about what was wrong with that and write those past wrongs. That's one way of doing it. I think what you pointed out before to your other patient that was so angry about reparations is a perfect example of raising a sort of consciousness in that person about, yes, they're being ripped off as much as anybody else. And the system tries to divide and conquer us. The system wants us to get angry at other people. I mean, it's a complicated raising of this consciousness in history. I mean, the chief reason there's such enormous discrepancy in wealth in the country between blacks and whites is, very simply put, the history of slavery. I mean, basically, if you're going to have people work for you for essentially nothing for hundreds of years, as whites did, whites are going to have a lot more money and blacks aren't. So that in itself, if you could get through to that person, should raise a sort of level of morality. Hey, yeah, that's not right. On the other hand, that person may have come from a background where there are people, whoever they may be, Jewish, Catholic, Irish, Italian, may have worked very, very hard to get to their position and resent the system taking something away from them as they perceive it. So I think the way to do that is, as you pointed out, we need a great national health insurance like you have in Canada there. And the resentment then will be a lot less.
Well, you know what's also really interesting, Jim, is that there was a 2016 study. So we're not talking 50 years ago. We're talking recent past. At one institution, medical institution, found that half of the medical students, and I am so curious, this would be something that maybe we could talk about with Dr. Gilligan, and found that half of the medical students and residents surveyed agreed with one or more false statements about biological differences based on race, such as the idea that black people had thicker skin and less sensitive nerve endings than their white counterparts. And the study only buttressed earlier surveys in which white physicians consistently categorized Black patients as less intelligent, and such false beliefs left unchallenged are worse tacitly reinforced by professors can lead a new generation of doctors to perpetuate discriminatory practices. I mean, that is really depressing to hear that in 2016, 2020, that this is still going on.
Doctors have had it. And it mainly, it's been a white male profession up until relatively recently. Things have become beginning to get rectified. And for decades and decades, again, doctors were seen as gods in this country. And that was backed up and reinforced by the American Medical Association and ways in which they were able to have certain people selected and limited their selection into medical school so that they can carry on more and more of their privilege. So every profession needs to look at that. And in terms of women, for example, the sexism within the medical profession has been notorious, let alone the racism. So we've got a big job ahead of us. And I think the more diverse we get.
And, you know, one of the things, too, that I have found in virtually all of the women's organizations, although I think that things may be changing, is that politics and certainly mental health up until recently, these were topics that were off the agenda. And these are exactly the kinds of issues that I feel that we should all be talking about, and that it reminds us of our own responsibility so that we can be introspective and ask ourselves, you know, what are we doing? Or are we doing anything at all when these kinds of situations come up? What is our role? What is our responsibility? What is our morality when we hear people talking in a disparaging way about Blacks or any minority group? And I feel we have a responsibility. And yet I think that probably, and I wonder whether you would agree, that the majority of people just simply don't want to get into it.
Well, yeah, there's a reluctance. There's a certain apathy. There's a certain fear. I mean, you don't have to go. So all you have to do is listen to the president every day. He'll come out with some of the most outrageous, negative and sexist and racist statements. And yet, for his whole life and through much of his presidency, he's gotten away with it. So we are responsible partly for this man being in office and not hitting back and not speaking back to his nonsense. And I've noticed recently some of the reporters have become a little more courageous. I'm sorry, who?
Even on Fox News, some of the people
they're beginning to stand out. So when you're living in such a toxic environment, dominated by that sort of narrative at the very top, it becomes difficult, even more difficult, to get beyond. But there's enough health, I think, in the American system and culture.
We'll see.
And especially
we'll
for the young people.
How healthy the American system actually is when it comes to the November election.
We will
find out soon enough how healthy the American people really are. Because look at Trump has had all of these psychopaths around him, including his daughter and senior advisors and son-in-law. I mean, people who've just enabled and encouraged his disgusting and really pathologically sick behavior. So
but again, we're the ones that are listening to it, and the newscasts that made a lot of money off of his nonsense and so on. So it's too easy to blame it all on him, and I think that's what you're trying to get at too. Here in having this discussion. And as you know, I'm a lifelong New Yorker and want to stay here forever and beyond. But if he gets in, I don't know. We'll have to maybe renew my visa to Canada there. You'll get me up there,
well,
right?
Well, that would be easy since you're married to a Canadian. That would
a
not,
Canadian, right.
That would not be an issue. But I just want to say
I'm not going to run away, though.
Jim. And, you know, we're talking about history, but this is not history. This is 2020.
No.
And
right.
COVID-19, right. Apparently, according to Dr. Tweedy, who I'm going to contact, and I'd like to have him on the show, has highlighted these issues, pathologizing. Now, listen to this. Black behavior leads to blaming black patients, as in the case of an Ohio physician and politician who publicly speculated last month that black people are more susceptible to COVID-19 because they don't wash their hands enough. I mean,
yeah,
really?
Right.
Really?
Well, some
so
people are too far gone.
There's
some people you just have to let go. And just, you're not, you know, they're too far removed. They're too polarized. They're too whatever, structured into a mindset is you're not going to reach them.
Right.
And I think you have to admit that and work with who you can. And do it in ways, I think, with a certain kindness, to be kind and loving as much as possible, but not to, you know, let them get away with it, with stuff, and just be insistent and stand up for what you believe. And that's what also this country is about.
No, exactly. Well, listen, I want to thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
I know you're for committing to
thank
your television
you.
Show, and this conversation
great show.
Will definitely be continued. Off air as well as on the Ask Beattie show. So we'll talk to you later. Thank you so
much. All right,
much.
Thanks.
Nick
Bretto, great show. Bye-bye.
Sociologist,
bye-bye.
Criminologist, and host of the Radical Imagination on MNN cable television. You know, going back to medicine really now, I think we all have an opportunity to reckon with our troubled past and redefine a new role. And a profession sworn, when you think about this, a profession sworn to heal can no longer passively accept the inequities it has witnessed for decades or the hand that it has played in them. Which goes back exactly to what I said at the beginning of this discussion, that indifference and enabling behavior is as bad as the act itself, because what we are saying then in not saying anything, in not speaking out, we are making a very, very strong direct statement. And that statement, my friends, is that it is okay. It is okay. You know, when I talk about enabling behavior, typically I talk about it in the context of relationships, of course. You're in a bad situation and you have to ask yourself, what is your role in keeping a really unhealthy, destructive, self-destructive dynamic going? You know, what is it that you are doing, or what is it that you are not doing that is saying, okay, it is okay for you to treat me badly. It is okay for you to ignore me. It is okay for you to abuse me verbally or sexually or physically or emotionally. And I think that it is very, very easy. And of course, I'm not talking about young children who may find themselves in very difficult situations. I mean, the kids have absolutely no power at all. But as adults, it's so easy to always blame the other person who doesn't treat me well, who doesn't call me enough, who doesn't, you know, give me the kind of loving support that I would like. But then again, I always say this to my patients, that it is so important then to be looking at what is it about me that is keeping this going. fear of loss, perhaps fear of being hurt physically or emotionally. And this is why when people find themselves in destructive or self-destructive situations, and you've tried everything that you could possibly try, and everything that you can possibly do, getting a second opinion, getting a second perspective on how you might be dealing differently and better in a way that would be in your best interest is really the best possible thing that you can do. Because being a passive bystander and not doing anything and just complaining and going along keeps the process going, whether or not it is a political process, whether or not it is a relationship process or a process at work. So this is where we have to really be very, very honest with ourselves and ask ourselves this really, really tough question about the role that we are playing, and if need be, if this role really needs to change and you have difficulty changing it on your own, reaching out and asking some help can make the biggest possible difference in your life and in your relationship. Well, there was a very interesting, another really interesting article in the New York Times, how to manage the emotional impact of getting laid off. And I know so many people who have lost their jobs and where companies have actually shut down. And this is a piece by a woman, Holly Epstein, and this is what she says. She says, about a week before I was laid off for the first time, my manager assured me that my job was safe. Have you heard this before? Do not worry. Your job is safe and secure. The company apparently was being restructured, but I was told, said Holly, that I needed and that my job was not going anywhere. Then the call came. I know this isn't what you expected, my boss told me. True, I wanted to say, but you said it wouldn't happen. But of course, I did not say anything. And then last month, just a few years later, I was laid off again, along with about 40% of the company. So we joined tens of millions of Americans whose jobs disappeared because of the pandemic, resulting in an unemployment rate, think about this, of about 13.3%, 13.3% in this country. So Holly asked herself, as everybody would be asking themselves, are my layoffs the run of bad luck, an occupational hazard, a natural effect of economic or industry volatility? Or, she says, as I think at my lowest moment, a pattern that reflects on me and my abilities. And it is so understandable. It is so understandable that in a situation like this that you start to question yourself. And if you too were laid off, you know how easy it is for your mind to cycle through these explanations. I'm a victim of misfortune. It comes with the territory. That's life. It's all my fault. But as you process your newfound joblessness, remember that the way you frame, and this is so true, your layoff is powerful. Probably the most compelling thing that you can do is to own your own narrative. But having said that, it's a trauma. It is a loss. a loss on all kinds of levels, a loss of identity, a loss of money, a loss of benefits, a loss of health care insurance. So you have to allow yourself to wallow and grieve, okay, for a period of time. You don't want this to go on for years and years. But it is a time to create something, some kind of meaning for what's happened. And, you know, for me, this is a time, I think for all of us with the pandemic, to really own your own emotions and to find ways to move forward in spite of what's happened and in spite of self-doubt. So if you can look at it, this is a time, perhaps, certainly to reflect and maybe to even reinvent yourself and reset. And maybe you really didn't want to be in the finance field, or maybe you really didn't want to be in the tech field, but that you thought that you should because the money was really great and you thought that there would never be a problem in terms of employment stability. So try to resist the impulse to kick yourself when you're down. Because self-criticism can be psychologically harmful, and it really hampers the ability to move forward. Because studies show that laid-off workers are prone to experience a wide range of negative effects, including mental and physical health issues, lifestyle and social life impacts, and newly stressful family dynamics. In fact, in a 2015 study from the University of Manchester, they found that people let go from jobs experienced an diminished ability to trust others for up to a full decade. And other research suggests that it can take longer to get over a job loss than the death of a loved one, because a job offers you or did offer you the sociability and a regular income and a place to go every single day where you'd be connecting with people, with live people, not just on Zoom. So you need to be careful how you frame it. You were not fired. You were not fired. You were laid off because of circumstances that had absolutely nothing to do with you, and that was completely beyond your control. And then, of course, you know, after you go through some time where you're feeling terrible and you're grieving and you're feeling depressed and you're feeling anxious and you're feeling scared, then it is time to start to take some meaningful action and figure out what is it that you need to do to be able to move forward, because action, my friends, is the best antidote to self-doubt. And if you do not get the kind of support, and sometimes families and friends are really not qualified, they're not able to give you the kind of support that you need, you know, hopefully you would be able to, even if it was for a short period of time, reach out to a career coach. And you may be pleasantly surprised to see that your next chapter may be a chapter that actually is going to resonate much, much better with who you are today and how you want to live your life. And I don't want to suggest that this is going to be something, that is easy to do. Because a layoff, I mean, let's face it, it's isolating, especially if you've been sheltering in place and working remotely. And if there's any consolation, remember that you're far from alone. And not only at the moment, most people experience employment gaps at some point. And one study found that some 40% of American workers have been terminated at least once, and that was before you know, all of the gestures that have been going on. So even though this is a scary, scary time for so many people, as I say, to be able to stop, and this is one of the things that I think can be viewed very positively as a result of the pandemic, it has actually, it has forced us. It has just forced us by the very nature that we just can't come and go like we were used to really stop, to be a lot more introspective, to reflect what I want, what I don't want, and to be able to actually reset and make some changes in your life that you may never have thought about making, and you may never have been in a position to actually do anything differently than the job you've done maybe for years and years and years. So, you know, hopefully this is going to be something that is motivational, you know, for you. And I'd really like to hear, you know, how you're doing in creating and recreating a new employment chapter in your life. Well, I'm looking at the clock here in my office on the Upper West Side in New York City. And it's quite amazing how an hour really comes and goes. There, I have so much material every week that I want to discuss with you, of course, about relationships and sex, but we're going to have to wait till next week to pick this all up again. And I want to thank you all so, so very much. You know, from listening to the Ask BD Show live, and of course you know that there is an Ask BD Podbean, which is the archives at the Progressive Radio Network. And if you are so inclined, you can go to the archives, Ask BD, and you can actually listen to my 307 shows as of today that I have done with the Progressive Radio Network over the last few years. So again, I want to thank you so much for listening and for emailing me and for calling. And I hope that you're going to have a really good rest of the rest of the day and rest of the week. And I like to close the show with my favorite song, and the song is "What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love." And if we ever needed love, sweet love now, it is certainly at this moment in time. Goodbye, everybody. Talk to you next week.